This is Mark Lane.
This is Robert Groden.
This is Dick Russell.
This is Jim Mars.
This is Lisa Pease.
This is Dr. David Mantic.
This is Cyril Weck.
This is Jim DiEugenio.
This is Joan Mellon.
This is David Lifton.
This is Jerry Polakoff.
This is Gary Shaw.
This is Bill Kelly.
This is Greg Burnham.
This is Gerald McKnight.
This is Sherry Feaster.
This is Joseph McBride.
This is Dave Ratcliffe.
This is David Talbot.
This is Doug Horn.
This is Walt Brown.
This is John Barber.
This is Bill Pepper.
This is Richard Belzer.
This is Oliver Stone.
This is Governor Jesse Ventura, and you're listening to Black Op Radio.
Video computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T-minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T-minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for
T-minus 20 seconds. T-minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T-minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another segment of Black Op Radio. Today we are speaking to Dan Hardway, a lawyer these days, but he was working on the House Select Committee on Assassinations and with Bob Blakey and with Eddie Lopez and a few others. They came up with a report that was supposed to be the report, and we're going to discuss that today because it is now available as an audiobook. So, hello, Dan. Thank you for taking part.
Hello. Thank you for giving me the chance.
Okay, great. So I think people listening to the show are probably well aware of you and Oswald in Mexico City and that. So I think we can get right to, you know, nitty gritty on some of the things. Now, just briefly, you mentioned, and it's in there, that this is a report that was supposed to be included in the final report. This was going to be the Mexico City group, whatever you guys called that group. This is your investigations of Lee Oswald's trip or footprint in Mexico City. Is that fair to say?
That's a fair characterization, yes.
Okay.
It was written as a first draft of the committee's final report into its investigation of activities in Mexico City.
And then it was supposed to be something that was going to be presented and that you felt maybe at that time, you know, the CIA may look at that, other people may look at that and decide to reopen something. So it seems to me that you had some kind of an honorable intention here to say, listen, there is more here, people, you know, look at this, you know. And the whole thing fell on deaf ears, and it may be the case that the agency did have a hand in the removal of John F. Kennedy and certainly the cover-up. And as we see through your other articles about George Ioannidis, I think your quote was, they had something to hide, and George Ioannidis knew what they had to hide, and that's why they pulled him out of retirement to handle you guys.
Yeah, I think so. I think that I was getting too close on several issues that Ioannidis was very familiar with, and his familiarity with that was deliberately hidden from us, and he directly addressed those issues in working with me and covered up essential information that we should have had. Most of that was not directly about Mexico City, however. Most of his knowledge there dealt with an area of the investigation into David Phillips' activities in regard to propaganda and his connections with the people who promoted the propaganda stories linking Oswald to Castro after the assassination, specifically some of the DRE people and some of the other operations that were run after the assassination, trying to link Oswald to Castro.
Right. Well, is that fair to say then that your investigation of, let me see, here's the quote, pattern of verified misinformation led to the CIA. So you guys were looking for a trail of where is all this misinformation coming from? And it leads,
that's what I was looking at, yes.
Right, and it leads to the CIA. Now,
it led to David Phillips.
Right. Do you know, I know other people say, they talk about, well, maybe it was a rogue operation or rogue this or rogue that. I mean, when you talk about the agency, do you think people were working independently or this is one big team?
I don't have enough information to be able to give
either
you a
way.
Definitive answer on that. My inclination would be that David Phillips was not running any kind of rogue operation to kill JFK. Whether or not there was something going on in the agency, and he was utilized in some way or another, that I find very, very possible. But it, again, you know, part of the issue here for me is, you know, I did this work 40 years ago, and I have not been in a situation where I can even completely review the stuff that's been done since. I just don't have the finances or the time or the finances to take the time to be able to go back and do the kind of research that I'd like to do and review of what's been released since then. Getting ready for this interview today and going over some of the Mexico City report and everything, I did look at some of it, and I'm pretty amazed at how much has come out and how much I didn't know back then. But there's so many connections there that weren't there then, or that I didn't know about that aren't in the report, that raise all kinds of avenues of investigation and raise all kinds of questions. Peter Dale Scott's done great work, John Newman, Mark Simpich. Bill Simpich, I'm sorry. No, the guy that wrote Someone Would Have Talked, Larry Hancock. I would like to be able to go back and do that because there is information there that I think leads inexorably towards a conclusion that there was intelligence involvement in setting up at least the cover-up in advance.
Right. Well, that's the conundrum. I mean, if you're setting up a cover-up in advance, you have to be part of it. Now, I think...
Exactly.
You know, a lot of people... Well, no, I'll say for myself, when I think that Alan Dulles had motive, means, and opportunity, and he had all the connections via everyone he knew and people loyal to him even after he's out of the loop, supposedly. But he, you know, someone like that in charge of agency, when these various people are on paper not linked up, that seems like a well-oiled machine. They all just fell into place to help this cover-up. Like you say, that it was set up like an avalanche. It just, you know, as soon as you start it, it goes. So every, you know, the idea that they'd have this disinformation campaign ready to go the minute the gunshots come out, you know, photos and background and everything on Lee Oswald and who is he and what he did. And I mean, even his, the whole arrest, the whole thing, it smacks of some kind of intelligence organization. And then when you get into the people, imposter, you know, that was one of my next questions about Mexico City. But I mean, I just don't see how people, when they get into the case, can make any defense of this. Or they just say, oh, it was a lone nut and he got these shots off and you're wasting your time on this. When you say, look at this trail of misinformation leading to the agency that is set up ahead of time. And that's what's interested me. Now, and I have a list of questions here, so I'll just, my question to you was, do you believe that the CIA was involved in the assassination?
I don't know.
Okay, fair enough. So,
let me give a qualified answer to that. And part of the reason I do this is because, you know, speculation doesn't get us any further down the street. And one of the things that I am proud of the work that we did and that Bob Blakey directed was that we tried to limit ourselves to clarify previous speculation, identify what we could know and what we didn't know, and try not to speculate too much on what we didn't know. Given that, if I were to say, is the CIA a suspect as an organization? Yes. I would like to see further investigation of them as a suspect. Do I think that there is evidence that exists out there to justify that? Maybe not on the basis as a prosecuting attorney might look for that in evidence, but on the basis of viewing it from the viewpoint of a counterintelligence operation or a foreign intelligence evaluation operation of whether or not a situation merits further investigation by the intelligence agency, I would say that it's clear and unequivocal that the situation needs more investigation from that standpoint. There is clearly enough information out there, I think, on an operational basis to say that someone should be looking at this. And, of course, one of the problems that you've got there and why you have a really hard time getting to the place of where you can say, well, from a prosecutorial or legal standpoint, there is or is not probable cause or reason to believe that a crime has been committed, is because of the built-in function of plausible deniability and the built-in role of propaganda and black operations to use to obscure the path of what was really going on.
Well, one quote, and I urge people to find the many interviews that you have given, as well as contributing to an episode of 50 Reasons for 50 Years, is that earlier, though, when you were talking about with Gaten Fonzie and Eddie Lopez, when you guys were sitting around talking, if you were speculating, one of you said the quote is, we have to think like they do. So
yep.
If you were going to pull this off, then you have to, you know, it's hard for people to say, well, I don't want to speculate and I don't want to give an opinion if I don't have, the evidence to back it up. But if you stand back and say, well, if they did this, how would they do it? How would they have patsies in maybe a couple of different cities? How would they set somebody up to take the blame in a way that no one could defend themselves? It's like, here's all this handing out communist literature and a defector to Russia and this, well, you know, right off the bat, I mean, who is this guy?
Yeah, you couldn't set it up much better, could you? I mean, you couldn't set up an operation much better to have the red herrings, the propaganda aspects, the built-in insulation against investigation. I mean, if in fact this was an intelligence operation, either at the organizational level, or if it was a rogue operation, it was a rogue operation at a very high level of the CIA where the person went rogue, then whoever it was that did it was a very sophisticated operator, very good at planning, and very good at detail and coordination. The CIA in the 70s and in the 80s and at various times since then has worked very, very hard to create the impression that they don't have that kind of competencies. And I think that all of us know that that's basically just a propaganda stance on their part. One of the things I learned working out there was that they most certainly did have those kinds of competencies. They were a very competent and very organized and very well-run organization. So, you know, given all that, yes, both organizationally and as potential rogue operators, I think that they have to be looked at very hard.
Now, what we're talking about here, people just tuning in, is Oswald, the CIA in Mexico City, and a.k.a. the Lopez Report. This is an audio book produced by Our Hidden History, and that's also available at ourhiddenhistory.org, but it's available at Black Op Radio. And so this is the audio book of this report put together. Now, a number of questions, I just want to get to a couple and we'll elaborate on them. Is there evidence that Lee Oswald went to Mexico City at all, in your opinion?
Yes, there's evidence that he went to Mexico City.
Do you think that he did?
I don't know. He may have. I mean, you know, there again, it's an area that's been investigated, but and may never be adequately investigated, but still has questions.
Well, can you explain then why there can be a gray area? I mean, you know, either he did or he didn't, or are we following a trail of crumbs laid out from someone to blind?
You know, when we say evidence, we're talking about is there indications, evidence, that Oswald went? Well, yeah, there is. There's testimony of people who claim to have seen him. There's, while it's questionable, there's certain travel records and bus records, and that's not something that we specifically got into in our part of the investigation, but it was covered by others, and, you know, the generation of some of those records is somewhat questionable, if not highly questionable, as was true with a lot of the records in the case. And, you know, whether or not they ever get admitted in a trial because of some of those questions is also highly questionable.
Well, let me change the question around then. Is it an opinion of yours that he could have been impersonated in Mexico City?
I think that's a distinct possibility, yes.
So we have a conundrum here. Someone is there. There are some records, if you want to believe them or not. But also the timetable. I mean, how can he be in the same two different places? I mean, he's supposed to be, you know, Texas, New Orleans, wherever, you know, and then at the same time in Mexico City. And yet the setup, all the different, you know, people who are supposed to heard various stories can't identify him. The photos, though, we don't have to get into that and the camera and all that, but I mean, all that should substantiate that, yet there's nothing really that they can say that says, well, this is Lee Oswald, yet there are statements of someone came in there and made a scene and started a lot of hollering and then left, and, you know, and it's up to us to try to put the pieces together.
Certainly, and you know, even with the eyewitness accounts of the folks in the Mexico City embassy or consulate, there's contradictions in them in his descriptions as to whether or not the person described was actually Oswald. That's, you know, those kinds of details we can get hung up in, but you know, if we're dealing with an intelligence operation, that's exactly what we would expect.
Right. Them to leave various trails for researchers to get caught on where you can't really be confident of who you're dealing with. Did some secretary meet Lee Oswald, or did she meet somebody who just said he was Lee Oswald?
And that is... You know, the critics of Warren Commission critics say, well, you know, that's a very easy out for someone like you, Mr. Hardway, because anytime you run into this kind of ambiguity, you can run that out and say that the ambiguity supports you. But that's not really what I'm trying to say. What I'm trying to say is when you go back and you look hard at what we can know from the records, we can be pretty sure there was a photograph obtained. What that photograph showed is open to question. I'm pretty well convinced myself that one of the tape recordings that was allegedly Oswald, at least one of them, survived and ended up in Dallas, where FBI agents who knew Oswald's voice said, that's not Oswald. And they also were shown a photograph at the time that they said was not a photograph of Oswald. And that became very highly controversial, and the agency didn't want to release a photograph even to the Warren Commission because of the alleged possibility that doing so would reveal their sources and methods of the photo surveillance they had on the Cuban embassy or the Cuban consulate. And although the Cubans already knew all about it, and the CIA knew the Cubans knew all about it, but they still didn't want to release it. But, you know,
well, let me just speculate.
Let me just finish this little speculation first. What if that photograph that had been produced, the initial reason why they really didn't want to release it was because it was a person who met the description that they put out of Oswald, but it wasn't Oswald? And what if the photograph that was taken to Dallas wasn't the one that eventually emerged as the Mystery Man photo? What if it was someone who actually meets some of those descriptions of the guy that was in Dallas, but wasn't Oswald? Well, what we've got now is we've got FBI agents in Dallas who are saying that we had a photo, but it wasn't Oswald, and we had a tape, and it wasn't Oswald. Well, you can't fake the tape near as easily as you can substitute a photograph. And now we've got a photograph that's clearly not Oswald, which we're told is the photograph that was taken to Dallas. And we're told now that, no, we were mistaken. There never was a tape. They didn't listen to a tape. The whole thing, to me, tends to indicate that there was a tape, there was a photograph, and neither one of them were of Oswald. You follow me?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's where a lot of people have been speculating that, you know, if they had anything, they'd be waving like a flag. Now, if they don't, they've got something to cover up, and it's not their incompetence, it's their covering up an intelligence operation where they have a double or an imposter. And they can't let that out, because as soon as they do that, they say, well, why would you have someone as an imposter? What kind of operation is going on here?
Well, that's part of it. But even if it was Oswald, you got the same issue.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you about a couple of people on the House Select Committee on Assassinations that were working with you. I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you got some opposition from Gary Cornwall, that maybe some people on the committee did not want to go in the direction that you guys were going in. Can you discuss any of that?
Well, I don't know what direction he wanted the committee to go in. He wasn't real supportive of me and Eddie.
Well, the reason I ask is just, you know, people may assume that, well, it was all one big team and everybody was working for the same goal. And when you find out, like, for instance, into the AARB or other things, that you go, no, there was people that thought that was a lone assassin. And what are you guys doing digging up there? What was one of the questions? What are you guys doing down in Miami? And Eddie says, trying to solve the case.
Yeah. Most of the people that I worked with there were at least agnostic on the issue, if not favoring the idea that there was a conspiracy. Gary, I can't recall ever having heard him express an opinion one way or the other, but I would imagine at best he was agnostic, and I wouldn't be surprised had he been a lone nutter to the very end. Matter of fact, I think I read his book when it came out quite a few years ago, and I think he expresses his belief that Oswald acted alone, not positive.
Yeah, but,
We didn't have, I don't think Eddie and I had to deal as much with Gary and problems that he created as some of the other guys on the committee might have done, because we got a lot of insulation for what we did from Bob. Bob pretty much ran interference for us on a lot of things.
Well, you know, that's encouraging to hear, and the more I learn and hear you talk about Bob Blakey, I become more neutral, because I had a dislike for him, because I thought that you know, studying the case for years and years, that he, how naive could he be? I mean, how can you keep saying that that we're going to just pin organized crime? And then the other thing I'd heard was that he was there to just kind of clean up after the, you know, Richard Sprague and Tannenbaum and others were kind of hot on the trail, and they were getting too warm, so they were removed, kind of sent
out.
That's
not true.
Oh, you don't think so?
That last is definitely not true.
Well, how would you describe your team coming in then? And so just correct me. I mean, I thought that Tannenbaum and Sprague and the previous people, where the rug was pulled out from under them.
Oh, I don't think the rug was pulled out from under Tannenbaum.
Oh, okay. Well, I meant Richard Sprague more because he was the figurehead, right? And what? Give me your opinion.
That's a huge another topic, and I think I've sent you some written materials on that. The biggest problem there, and try to do a thumbnail on this, is that they went in thinking that they could act like prosecuting attorneys in a congressional investigation. A congressional investigation has no prosecutorial authority and has no prosecutorial responsibilities. A congressional investigation is a factual investigation with the aim of creating legislation to better the situation. We couldn't have we never could have indicted anyone. We didn't have a prosecutor's authority. They went in and tried to run the committee like a prosecutor's office, and everything blew up on them. And when it blew up on them, they basically left. And it was left a huge mess in which the committee had basically lost the confidence of the Congress and was in serious doubt of even whether or not it was going to be allowed to finish its work. And with the constraints that were created as a result of the fiasco of the way Tannenbaum and Sprague left, the half-life, if you will, of the committee was severely restricted. And the issue was then, within the parameters of what is appropriate for a congressional committee to do, what can be done? And within those parameters, it was in those parameters that Bob had to work. And what a committee can do is produce a report and suggest legislation. So the objective became to focus on that because of the time constraints that we were under, and get as much as we could out and into the public record in the best way that we could, and to preserve what we found. And, you know, when you realize that we had to have such limited objectives in order to be able to accomplish anything up there at this point, that in that context, what he did is an amazing and remarkable job of first-rate work. You know, now, you know, today when I go back and look at what we did and review the work that I did and then start reading stuff that has come out since, I kick myself in the butt and say, why didn't I ask for that file? How did I miss that connection? But you got to understand, when we started, there was nothing out there of any kind of substance or significance. We started basically in the dark. And, you know, most of what we found for forms the basis of what the Assassination Records Review Board was able to find and disclose. And it was collected and saved in large part because of the work that we did. And Bob, given the constraints, you know, was he a prosecutor? Did he go at it like that? Was he able to do what Tannenbaum and Sprague said they had originally set out to do? No. Did he try to do what they said they'd set out to try to do? No. Why didn't he do it? It's because you can't do it in a congressional committee. And, you know, the most amazing thing about those two guys is that they still don't admit that the basic problem they had was they were trying to do something that they weren't authorized to do. And when what they weren't authorized to do blew up in their face, as it was bound to, because they didn't have the authority to try to do the things they were doing, then instead of stepping back and saying, well, okay, within the parameters of what we can do and what we're legitimately here for, what can we do to salvage what we have left of this, regain the confidence of the Congress, and accomplish something to move the Kennedy case down the road, they cut and ran. So, yeah, well, Bob came in to clean up their mess, but it's not in the context where he always gets labeled and libeled as being a tool of someone or something. He came in and did what he could as a man with integrity trying to move the Kennedy assassination down the road as far as the investigation was concerned. Sorry, you got me preaching a little bit.
No, that's fine, because that's your opinion. That's what it's for. You know, I want to talk to you, and you give me your opinion, you know, whether I agree or disagree. And I, most of the time, I just like to learn. So I guess my point was not so much with Bob Tannenbaum, but with Sprague. It was my opinion that he was unceremoniously run out of town. Like you say, they may have bit off more than they could chew. They certainly came up against opposition that they weren't ready to handle, and it could be the case that they thought, listen, we're going to go in and, I mean, there was a lot of other people, I think, Mark Lane and other people trying to get this and other things really investigated when they hadn't been. But let's leave that alone, because I did want to ask you your opinion about Blakey, and I think you were happy to see that he's come around a little bit in his last statement. I think in 2014, you were at a conference with him where this stuff about George Joannides and a deception where, you know, he felt that he was taking agencies at their face value and trusting them. And now he is saying that some of these things really were things went on behind his back that throw a different light into the investigation. I mean, I don't know if we ever open this up again, if there will be a something else, right? Maybe after something there may be. But for people just interested, for me, the thing that really piques my interest is listening to this report you've made, is that you guys kicking a hornet's nest, that after you start looking for where is the disinformation coming from, who is creating this, and seems to be ready in the chamber. So as soon as something comes out, they have some reporter or somebody else leak something to talk about Castro or the Soviets or something. It all seems to be coming from the agency, whereas if it was a lone assassin, none of this stuff would be pre-prepared, ready to go. And, you know, just the way that you guys were handled, like you say, all you had to go to the CIA now, and you had to sign in, and you had to go to a special room, and when you requested documents, they had to be put in the safe afterwards, and your notes had to be put in the safe as well, and you couldn't take any notes. I mean, once you start seeing what you're up against, and you detail that in episode 44 of the 50 Reasons, you very articulately, I think it's about a 10-15 minute episode there. You lay all that out. I don't think that anyone following the case can fall back on a lone assassin after that. You see what kind of effort was up against your investigation.
Well, yeah, but the existence of the cover-up doesn't necessarily prove the conspiracy. That's not real solid inferential logic on the case. There's other possible motivations, possible reasons why they may have wanted to cover things up. Whether or not that was the reason or because they were trying to cover up involvement, you know, is another question. But the one conclusion doesn't necessarily follow from the other. That being said, I think that when you get into looking at the cover-up,
well, to me, it's too orchestrated.
What they have now acknowledged to be a cover-up, the CIA last year or the year before admitted that they had participated in a limited cover-up, as they said, or as they called it, a benign cover-up of CIA in connection with the Kennedy assassination, let's put it that way. careful reading of the article in which they made that admission is really fascinating as to what they actually admit to. And when you read that, it's not unlike them acknowledging that what they were covering up was some type of connection to anti-Castro operations and the assassination. I think that I've got some stuff that I blogged on on my blog that goes into that in a little more detail. But none of that's in the report. That's all stuff that's come out since.
Right. I'll try to make links to that then. Now, in your report, I heard it said that you and Eddie were trying to be matter-of-fact about it and not speculate too much. And it was given to someone on your team, Mike Goldsmith, who went over it and maybe smoothed it out a bit. Can you discuss that at all? I don't know too much about Mike. Or is it Mike or Mickey?
Mickey Goldsmith.
Right.
And the book that's on tape and the book that's available from the Mary Farrell Foundation is mine and Eddie's work. This does not have any editing to it. The copy that is here is the draft that I literally typed myself on an IBM Selectric. This draft is never made it any further than the initial declassification review with the CIA. Bob basically said that as they sat down and started to go through this draft to talk to the CIA about what they would allow or agree to be published out of it, that they basically got through about four paragraphs in 2 or 3 days, at which point they realized that they weren't going to be able to get the CIA to agree to declassification of it. Personally, I think congressional committees have the authority to declassify on their own, but this committee was not in any kind of position to even consider such a thing, as weak as it was. That being the case, then the CIA classified it, and it remained classified until the AARB got it declassified. One of the most interesting things about the hard copy of the book that I don't think you're going to get in the red version of it is someone, and I think it was probably someone in the CIA, made marginalia notes in the draft that's been declassified. And for example, where I talk about the transmittal manifest that I think sent the photographs to DC in the draft, I make the statement that CIA has informed us that all transmittal manifests are untraceable. Well, someone has written in the margin at that point, not necessarily, which I find to be interesting.
For people who are not aware of that, can you just elaborate a little bit? Because this is records that have been admitted as a record, and then they put to be excluded, so that if someone is doing a search for something, that this is going to be excluded, and researchers may not have items released because they're supposedly, quote, now not part of the record yet.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that they've determined not to be related and things like that that you don't normally get a chance to see.
Well, you know, if you're investigating, to me, it's all one and the same. So if you're talking about Mongoose and Miami and all these people that were in one situation, anti-Castro, and then, possibly on directions of Phillips or Alan Dulles or other people, or, you know, on Ed Lansdale, they decided to take matters in their own hands and they remove Kennedy. When you go back and find the other things that were going on at the time, it is all part and parcel. And at least, of interest to me, and I think other people, that, you know, maybe this isn't their only operation. So, do you have any opinion on that, that the teams that were behind removal of Castro were turned around and sent after Kennedy?
depends on what you mean by turned around.
Okay, well, no problem. I just was asking if you had just anything, you know, without evidence, just any opinion on the discussion here. Just
I think that some of the people who were plotting to kill Castro could very easily be involved in the plots to kill Kennedy. I think that that's a fertile place to look for potential leads.
Right, that was my next question. Where would you look today? Let's say someone was producing a TV show and they had a lump sum of money and they said, we can hire a few people. Where would you look?
Start with giving me enough money to be able to go up to take a year off from work and go up and do some research at the National Record Centers and in the archives.
No problem.
Right? Yeah, I've often wondered whether or not I could get crowdsource funding to take a year off and go do some research and follow up on some of the stuff that's come out, because some of the stuff is just absolutely amazing. I mean, you know, we were told that June Cobb wasn't an agent. Well, she very clearly was. And I mean, June Cobb, Joe Piccolo, Barney Hidalgo, all those guys get linked together in the information that's come out since. And all those guys, we were told that, you know, we were lied to right and left about all these guys. And the stuff that's come out now, when I start putting it back together, I'm just floored at what's actually out there. There's massive amounts of material, but it takes the kind of detailed, painstaking work that me and Eddie were doing back then to pull the stuff out and piece it together and find the threads and say this one is actually connected to that one. And there's not hardly anyone that I know of that's doing that kind of work, with the exception of Newman and Simpich and, to a lesser extent, Hancock. And I don't think Peter Dale Scott's doing much of it anymore. But that's the kind of work that has to be done. John Newman and Bill Simpich are definitely doing that kind of work. But the amount of detail that's out there is massive, and more people need to be able to do that kind of work. But in order to do that, you've got to have some background in it. You've got to have some understanding to even know how to start and what to look for. And at this point, most of the people who are potentially involved or who would have information, most of them are dead. And we're basically, the case has gone into the stage of where it's now a historical investigation rather than a forensic investigation. And we're basically stuck at where we have to rely on the documentation rather than live testimony. You know, there's a few people around that are alive that might have some information that would be helpful if they're willing to talk, but the rest of it, we're pretty much looking at the documentation to try to figure it out.
Now, when you talk about going to National Records or something like that, when you were in the committee, you had certain abilities to subpoena people or get people to testify. But earlier you mentioned the problem with the timetable, and maybe this is something you could just address. The difference between a select committee, which this was, and a standing committee?
Yeah, a select committee is created by the Congress for a limited time for a special purpose, and has to be renewed every time there's a new Congress. So, you know, like after every 2 years, there's a new Congress, effectively. And one of the first things that a new Congress does is it reauthorizes, and it's usually pro forma, it reauthorizes the select committees that were created in the previous Congress. Needless to say, to the great amazement of people working for the House Select Committee on Assassinations, the new Congress in 1977 did not do that. And it was a real question of whether they were going to get renewed at all. But a standing committee, on the other hand, like the Senate Intelligence Committee or the House Intelligence Committee now, is a committee that's a permanent committee of Congress and stays in existence regardless of the change in congressional sessions, et cetera, and doesn't have to do reauthorization. And consequently, it's a much more secure, comfortable position for the committee. It doesn't have to worry about whether it's going to be in existence next year. It's there as a permanent part of the operating system of the Congress, absent some reason that they may develop for getting rid of them. Select committees, on the other hand, basically exist at the sufferance of the Congress.
Right. So with this committee, time was the number one factor. And then the idea that Bob Blakey wanted to...
Well, yeah, and that time was even more pressing because of the, you know, the fiasco of the way the committee started led to the constant threat that the Congress would cut off the committee's funding. A select committee is dependent upon congressional funding for its existence, and the whole Congress has to agree to fund the committee. And the problem after the fiasco with Gonzales, and Gonzales has to bear a huge amount of the responsibility for that. The problem was that Congress, even after they finally reauthorized the committee's existence, did not fully fund the committee and kept threatening the committee's finances basically through the rest of the life of the committee, and put demands on the committee staff. Actually, Congress put the demand on the committee, which put the demand on the staff for updates on work and justifications for continued funding, and just the committee worked under conditions that I think probably no other congressional committee, either select or permanent, has ever had to deal with.
Now, do you have an opinion that this is animosity to personalities, or the Congress really didn't want this investigated?
I think that it was largely a political issue. On the one hand, that the Congress didn't want embarrassed again. On the other hand, there was probably quite a bit of animosity towards the committee, because probably, and here I'm speculating, I don't have evidence, and there's another thing I'd love to be able to do sometime is go back and look at the history of what happened in more detail there when everything blew up. But there was probably quite a bit of animosity, I think, if you go look at it, about the investigation into the King assassination. I think that probably generated a little more congressional resistance, especially from Southern congressmen, than the Kennedy assassination did. But because the blow-up and all the fireworks happened over on the Kennedy side, that never became an issue that really went public. That's just my speculation.
That's your insight. Okay, great. And we talked about... Oh, well, you never really did answer. I don't know Mickey Goldsmith at all. Is there anything you can tell listeners that didn't know him, that what were his contributions or role?
Oh, Mickey was a brilliant attorney. He was sharp. He was very supportive of me and Ed. He backed us up when we'd get in disputes with other staff people. He backed us up in our disputes with the CIA. The CIA did not like me and Eddie, and he backed us up both in dealing directly with them and in dealing with Bob and mainly Gary about CIA complaints about me and Ed. And the whole time I worked there, I had nothing to criticize about Mickey.
Oh, that's fine. Okay. I just, you and Eddie are often talked about, but some of the other people aren't, and I just wanted to, you know,
Team Five. Mickey headed up Team Five. It was him and Bob Ginsman and Betsy Wolf, and there was a whole bunch of folks on Team 5, and none of them were people that I thought were inadequate or unfit or unable to do the work. I was impressed with all of them and with all their work. Of course, you know, our motto was that reality is irrelevant, which was a Gary Cornwall quote.
Yeah. All right. Well, we do have the audiobook available, Oswald, the CIA in Mexico City, a.k.a. The Lopez Report. And this audiobook is written by Dan Hardway and Ed Lopez. And what you're telling us is that this is before it was softened at all for presentation, for acceptance by the CIA, which, like you said, the first page, it took them over 2 hours just to get through the beginning, so that was a lost cause trying to get them to add this to the report. So we're lucky in the time frame
that they had to deal with it in.
So we're lucky we have it. It's available at audiobook, and I guess maybe just to summarize, is there anything you'd like to leave listeners with, which summarizes your experience in this one area investigating Oswald in Mexico?
Dare to educate yourself. Go dig it out. Look for yourself.
All right. Good. Well, I look forward to speaking to you again soon. But in the meantime, thank you so much for taking time today.
And, you're very welcome.
Is there anything else you're working on that you'd like anybody to know about, just not on the topic?
Not at the moment, no.
Okay. I remember last time I did have you on, you said you were very interested in the amount of crimes that are now being labeled felonies. And it's just unbelievable that, you know, how things were small, petty crimes, and now they're a felony. And we had a discussion about that a few years ago. But I just thought I'd offer if you had anything else up.
Yeah, well, there for a little while, it looked like we might get some rationality in the area under Obama and get some reform started in the criminal justice system, but it looks like the possibility of that happening is now gone. It's just an irrational.
Yeah, let's leave that
area
alone for now then. Okay. Mr. Hardway, thank you so much. I'll talk to you again.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Lynn.
Okay. Good night.
Mm-hmm. Good night.
Black Op Radio is pleased to announce a direct download section. That's right. Now you can purchase all archive shows and specialty packages such as the John Armstrong interview, Doug Horn, Jim Douglas, Jim DiOginio, and more. So instead of having to wait with regular mail, you can get shows you want in minutes directly to your computer. Check out the direct download section at blackopradio.com.
Black Op Radio presents Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, the DVD Complete Collection. Finally, the DVD set you've been waiting for is available. Over 15 hours with Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty. Over 15 hours. Interviews with Len Osanek, John Judge, David Ratcliffe, and more. This is a one-of-a-kind set. These interviews feature Fletcher Prouty having candid conversations regarding his 23 years in the military, but specifically 9 years in the Pentagon from 1955 to 1964. His inside knowledge is invaluable to researchers of this era of American and world history. These are the revelations you've been waiting for. Over 15 hours with Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, the complete DVD collection. Available at the Colonel Prouty reference site, www.prouty.org, and blackopradio.com. It's a political rally, a free speech zone, a town hall meeting. It's an interrogation at NSA headquarters. Now, it's time to make a statement. Time to represent. Time to let them know who you are. That you're part of the Black Op. With a brand new Black Op Radio t-shirt. Comes in all sizes. Wear it loud and proud. Join the Black Op today. www.blackopradio.com. If you believe there's more to the JFK assassination and the mystery surrounding the CIA and its covert operations, you're not alone.
Meet the man Oliver Stone called X in the epic motion picture JFK. Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty comes forward with never before seen or heard documentation and information about JFK, the Vietnam War, the CIA, and more on a brand new CD-ROM. The collected works of Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty is an incredible offer not to be missed. For a limited time only, find the answers surrounding these issues and more with the collected works of Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty. Or visit the Colonel Prouty reference site on the World Wide Web, the collected works of Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty.